العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد
وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. I'd like to start by expressing my condolences on the coming of the night of Ashura. And we ask that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless us with the understanding and the knowledge and the ma'rifah that one must have to understand the depth of this sacrifice and this event. Inshallah, we'll spend a few minutes in regards to the ahkam and we'll continue with tonight's discussion. Tonight I'd like to speak about another aspect of prayer, which is the jama'ah prayer, the congregational prayers. We know that in Islam, the congregational prayers are extremely important and emphasized. And this comes out of the concept and notion that we've been speaking about the past few nights of brotherhood and unity. And congregational prayers is a form of ibadah that we establish and we continue to establish, and we grow our brotherhood between other Muslimin. So congregational prayers are highly recommended, and so long as there are two people that are praying, one can perform jama'ah prayers. A few things in regards to jama'ah prayers. One is that a lot of times we see, unfortunately, in communities that individuals don't connect to or join the jama'ah prayer correctly. We know that the jama'ah prayer, one does not necessarily have to only join from the beginning. So if someone is joining later, it's still permissible to pray jama'ah. But depending on where they join, one must perform certain things and one must either wait or must join the prayers in a specific fashion. If one was to reach the jama'ah prayer in the first rak'ah, after the imam has started, before going to ruku', he would make the intention of praying jama'ah prayer and say his takbiratul ihram and join the prayer just like any other follower, and he continues with the imam. Second rak'ah, the same way. Before ruku', if he joins, same way. He joins the imam in the state that he is performing qara'ah. He's reciting the surah Fatiha and the other surah, or qunut, doesn't matter. If someone is joining the prayer when the imam is in ruku', this is the last stage that someone can join the imam. That means if the imam is standing, one can join. If the imam is in ruku', if you join and reach the imam while he's in ruku', then the jama'ah is fine. One has joined and is now connected. But if the imam is has risen after the ruku', or is in a state of sajda, then one cannot join the prayer then. So, if one joins and the imam is going to ruku', it's important to make sure that one, the person already has the intention. And remember, the intention of prayer or any worship, act of worship, ibadah, it isn't necessary for one to say it with their tongue. A lot of times we misunderstand this teaching that the niyyah, the intention, must be said. No, it's not necessary. So long as one understands exactly what they're doing and for what reason, that suffices. So, one makes the intention, does the takbiratul ihram. If the imam is in ruku', it is necessary, please make a point of this, it is necessary for the person to be in a standing state at least for a second or a split second, an instant, before joining the imam in ruku'. See, a lot of times we see that the imam is in ruku', so we quickly want to join. We do the takbir and in one motion go straight to the ruku'. This is a problem. You must do the takbir, wait one instant, and then join. So if it's one motion, there's a problem here. So that's one in regards to joining prayers when the imam is in the ruku'. Now, if one is joining the jama'ah and the imam is in the third raka'ah or the fourth raka'ah, we know that the imam at that point does the tasbihat. So, our scholars say it is recommended for one to wait until the imam is in the state of ruku' to join the prayers. Why do they say this? Because in jama'ah prayers, we know in the first and the second raka'ah, when the imam does the surah al-fatiha and the other surah, then the individual who is following the imam, it isn't necessary for them to do that. But in the third and fourth raka'ah, everyone praying must do the tasbihah. Just because the imam is saying it, it isn't enough for the followers. So, if you join the Imam, and he's in the third rak'ah, and he's standing, if you join during that state, it is necessary for you to at least recite Surah Fatiha. Now, if you join in the middle of the rak'ah, obviously, sometimes there won't be enough time to do that. So you'll expose yourself to playing this catch-up game with the Imam, or rushing yourself, and trying to finish your Fatiha, and try to catch up with the Imam before he continues with the prayer. So our scholars say, wait till the Imam has gone to ruku', then join the prayer, and continue with the Imam like that. So that's the next one. The last case is that sometimes we find out the jama'ah is being performed, or we would like to join the jama'ah when the jama'ah is almost done. Now they say that one can also join the jama'ah, but in this case they only benefit from the blessings, but he must continue with their prayers. For example, the Imam is in the fourth rak'ah and he's doing sajda, and now you know they're doing jama'ah and you know they're almost finished. You also want to get the blessings and take the blessings from the prayer, because it's recommended. So what must one do? He makes the niyyah, the intention of praying his prayer, for example, Salatul Dhuhr, Asr, whatever. He joins the Imam in sajda, and he continues with the Imam in the tashahhud as-salam. He's in the state that his knees are not touching the ground. He's sitting and rising in a sense. But when the Imam finishes, he rises and he continues his own prayer from the beginning. See, this is the difference that, again, we have in the fiqh and the ahkam of our school of thought and of other schools of thought in Islam. In some schools of thought in Islam, if the Imam is any part in the prayer, one can join. And if they join the Imam, even that small amount will suffice for the whole prayer. For example, some schools of thought, if you join the Imam in the last rak'ah and he's in sajda, so long as you make connection, you join him, and you finish and do tashahhud salam afterwards, your prayer is complete. It isn't necessary for you to continue then. But in our school of thought, this isn't the case. So if we join the Imam in whichever rak'ah, then we must continue to perform whatever rak'ahs are left. And if we join at the end, it is only for the intention of the blessings. And then when we continue, our intention automatically switches from the jama'ah to the farada prayer, which one does by themselves. So inshallah, please pay attention to these points. It's unfortunate that we see this a lot in communities, that brothers and sisters don't pay attention to this point of joining the jama'ah and joining it properly. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So last night and the previous night, we were speaking about the goals of the Holy Imam in regards to his sacrifice, his resistance, his revolution, from his own words. And we stated the Imam had two major objectives and goals which he wanted to achieve. One was that of reform and revolution, Islah, and one was that of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. So, last night we defined what enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is. We mentioned how important it is in Islam. And we mentioned what would happen if we were to abandon this responsibility that we had. Because we know this is of the furu' deen. All Muslims are responsible towards performing this action. Just like we all pray, just like we all fast, and so on and so forth. And we mentioned the stages of how one would perform this enjoining of the good and forbidding of the evil. The stages. Tonight we'd like to look at, again, this concept, but in a different perspective. First, we want to understand a more broad definition of this enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Then we want to look at the different forms that it has. Because last time we only looked at the stages. We didn't look at the different forms of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. So we'll begin with the definition, a more broad definition. What does it really mean to enjoin the good and forbidding the evil? And what is our ultimate goal by doing this? Why is this a responsibility that we all have? This action, our ultimate goal, is to affect someone somehow. And because this is linked towards our Islamic teachings, we want to establish a change in another human being for their own good and the good of society. That means it is a change that is beneficial to everyone. Not that we want to instill a change in them for our own benefit. This is obviously not the case. So our ultimate goal is for us to help them become better people. With that in mind, how can we go about achieving this ultimate goal? Is there only one way of doing it? Are there multiple ways of doing it? Which of these forms and ways has Islam certified and allowed us to do? So, the first form of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil to reach this goal is that of educating an uneducated person or an ignorant person. This has a number of different forms. The first form is for us to educate an individual who is uneducated and ignorant, but his ignorance or his uneducation is not because of his own fault. That means he is uneducated, but it's not his fault. And Islam makes reference to this person. The term used is a jahil. Jahil in Arabic means someone who is ignorant. Jahil qasir. That means someone who is ignorant, but their ignorance is not their own fault. Which means what? Which means this person is receptive towards learning the teachings of Islam, towards learning moral teachings. Rather, they don't have resources available to them for them to come to understand and become educated in regards to these issues. They don't have the resources available to them to understand what their responsibilities are as a Muslim. And in a more broader scale, which we're talking about, how we can apply this, these teachings of the Holy Imam to all of humanity, so on a more broad scale, how they can be a better person. So, the first step, the first issue we need to look at is, what is our responsibility towards this person? Sharia says, it is wajib, obligatory, for you to educate this person. How? You need to prepare, and you need to bring into existence resources that this person can now use towards educating himself towards his responsibilities in Islam. Now, where does this lack of education stem from? What are the roots of these things? One is that we have not been able to spread and portray the true message of Islam. Meaning what? Look at the lack of resources we have, especially in this country. One, we have a lack of qualified scholars. So, a lack of qualified scholars will result in what? A lack of education in the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim community, and more generally and wider, the society in general, in regards to Islam. So we have a shortage of qualified scholars. Now, where do scholars come from? Are scholars individuals sent from the heavens, and they assign them towards regions? Does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala say, you scholars are assigned towards East Coast, you are assigned towards the West Coast, you go to Africa, you go to Asia? No. Scholars, we know, are all individuals just like us. But they understand the fact that it is necessary for some human beings, as per the command of the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that they understand, study the religion in depth, and then dedicate their lives towards helping others and educating them in regards to these responsibilities. That's their only goal, to educate people. So, how do we go about eliminating this problem, this weakness? We need to understand that we are responsible at some level towards understanding the religion and help educating people in regards to that. But we also need to understand this deficiency and this lack of Islamic scholars is because we really don't invest in this notion of making and producing scholars. How? We don't even feel responsible or encourage our children or people that we know towards this responsibility that we have. Yes, this is something that we really need to speak about, especially with the youth. When one chooses a career, what factors and elements should he take into consideration? This is a monumental issue that almost, that you can see that in society most people have not thought about. Most people choose their careers based on their likes, what they like, and what they feel like they have potential in. So they know that they have an attraction and a desire toward, for example, technology, and they know they have potentials towards understanding the ins and outs of, let's say, computer systems, towards engineering issues and things of that nature. So one then comes to the conclusion that I can be a good engineer, therefore I should pursue a career in engineering. And they see that I can also serve society by being an engineer. So one of the things that one must take into consideration is what need the society has. Now it is good that our children are becoming engineers. It is good that they're becoming doctors. It's good that they're becoming lawyers. It's good for them to excel and advance to the highest levels of education. But we also need to pay attention towards the other needs of society. Everyone doesn't need to be a doctor. Everyone doesn't need to be an engineer. There's a certain limit that we know this many people will suffice towards society's needs towards engineering. This is if we're looking at this only from a Muslim perspective right now. Because we acknowledge that, yes, society needs engineers because of today's shape and form of how things work. We need doctors, we need lawyers, we need journalists, we need people in the arts and so on and so forth. But as Muslims, we also understand this need of the existence of scholars, Islamic scholars, religious scholars. So since we understand this, let's say that no one else understands this but Muslims, because we see ourselves a step higher than everyone else, unfortunately. So we understand this need. Why is it that we're not investing in it? What's the problem here? So we have knowledge, but it's not turning into action. So this could be because of a number of reasons. One is because of, we talked about one of the social factors that existed during the time of Imam Hussein, led to this revolution and led to the resistance against the Imam, is the lack of Iman in faith. Some of us think that, yes, if our children were to become scholars, it's almost like it's a failure in life. Because for him to be a doctor is more prestigious than for him to be a scholar. Therefore, for my child to become a scholar, it doesn't look good. It makes me look bad. It means he has some sort of a deficiency. He couldn't be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, and so he became a scholar. Some people think like this. Some of us don't even feel like it's necessary. No, it isn't necessary for our children to become scholars. Let the scholars be trained in other parts of the world, since there are so many of them, and let them just export that like a commodity to the rest of the world. Let them send from the houses of Najaf and from Qom and from Pakistan, it's fine. Let all the scholars come from there. Our children are in America, let them become doctors. This is a problem that we have. And if you pay attention, you can see the effects that this has. When we put this responsibility on the shoulders of others, obviously there will be deficiencies. When someone comes to a country and doesn't understand the culture, how do they want to be able to successfully express the religion and explain the religion to the people of this nation? You have a problem, you have a deficiency that if you really pay attention to the where we are in this country in regards to Islamic education and performing the responsibilities and tasks that are necessary, you can see how behind we are. So this is something that we need to make up for. So we need more qualified scholars. Second, our Islamic centers need to grow, and they need to, again, offer more resources and activities that are Islamically related. Islam doesn't always have to be taught and spread by someone speaking, by the tongue. Islam can be spread through a number of different activities. Our Islamic centers need to grow to be able to incorporate these things. Now yes, some communities are smaller than others. It's understood. If you have a community of only, let's say, 500 people, you don't need to have a center that will cater to 10,000. We're not saying to be wasteful and to do israf. But at the same time, we need to understand, for us to help individuals gain and grow academically, and for their knowledge to be able to help them towards being good Muslims, we need to be able to cater to that at different levels. So this education process needs to exist. Each person at his own level. Each person in his own way. You can't have one form and try to push that on everyone. This will not be an effective way of doing things. And for those who've done that, they know the problems that exist there. So that's the first reason and root that we have this problem. The second is that some people are really representing Islam, but their representation of Islam is not the true Islam. Again, we talked about the roles and the qualities of hypocrites. Yes, in this country, who are the driving force and really who are the individuals who are reaching the masses in regards to Islam and its purpose? You think it's the scholars? Of course not. The reason we have so much Islamophobia in this country is because people are speaking about Islam that have no idea what Islam is. And therefore this results in a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding in regards to true Islam and Islamic responsibilities. So these are two things. So that's the first case. The first case is an individual who is ignorant and uneducated, but it's not his fault. That's the first. The second is, again, the person is ignorant, uneducated, but he is at fault here in the sense that the resources are available to them, but they either are not motivated or they don't care. Now, this can be in two forms. We call this jahil muqassir. This can be in two forms. Sometimes an individual doesn't know at all. That means they have no education at all. They don't know how to pray, they don't know how to fast, they don't know what it means to be a Muslim. They just have the Muslim name because they come from a Muslim family and that's it. You might as well just put another name on him and you can say he's not Muslim at all. Anyways, some people are like that. In some cases, no. They have a general understanding of things. For example, a lot of our youth are like this, unfortunately, in this country. They know certain things about Islam. They know certain actions of Islam. They know that prayer is a part of religion. And they know, for example, how to pray. But they don't understand the reasonings and philosophies behind these actions. So this person has resources available to him. It's not that there's no Islamic center. It's not that his parents don't know about Islam. It's not that they don't have some sort of access towards Islamic knowledge. Rather, the person doesn't feel like it's worth their time. They don't care. They're not motivated. So what is our responsibility towards this kind of individual? If the person is asking for help, again, it's obligatory and wajib for us to help and educate him. If the person is not asking for help, which most cases is like this, because they're so disconnected, they don't feel the need towards understanding religion. If they are not asking for help, again, our responsibility is we are obligated towards teaching them and enjoining them to the good and forbidding them from the evil. But now it has to be in a different form. Our education is not simply just to tell them. That means it won't suffice for us to say, Ali, Hassan, whoever, as a Muslim you have to pray, and if you don't pray, Allah will be displeased with you. Just saying that doesn't suffice. Your responsibility towards enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Rather, you must approach this person in a way that will create this drive and motivation for them to, again, connect themselves to religion. You see, there's a big difference here. You can't just tell them something that is right and something that is wrong. If the person isn't motivated, if you tell them a million times, they'll never do it. Speaking to the parents, how many times have you told your children to do certain things and you see that they just don't do them? I know in my life, my father and my mother told me things probably 1,000 times, which is wrong. I should listen the first time. But they have to tell me to do something so simple 1,000 times. And I know this exists in all communities. So what's the problem here? You have to tell them a million times? Is it necessary, or do they have a mental deficiency that they can't understand? When you get up, for example, in the morning, you have to perform Salat al-Fajr. Yeah. And so on and so forth. Our experience shows that our children don't have mental deficiencies because they're becoming the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers. So there's something else wrong here. What's wrong is that they have not been motivated, Islam has not been properly introduced to them, and therefore they don't see the need of religion in their life. They fill the void of religion with other things that will not satisfy what religion is supposed to satisfy and will lead to an imbalanced life. Whether now or later, it'll show itself. So we need to motivate them. We need to use methods that will help them become reconnected with religion and understand its importance, so that once you're able to get them back on track, the rest of the work will be done by them. Teach them how to walk and they will run themselves. So you don't have to hold their hand in every stage in life. Proper training and proper upbringing is like this. As a good parent, you don't want to have to be by your child's side every stage of their life and hold their hand. Yes, when they're children, you're responsible towards doing that. But you don't want your child to become a grown man and for you to still hold his hand towards doing very simple things. It's a failure in parenthood and parenting. You want to make this individual independent in a sense. So you also want to make him independent towards his responsibilities in religion and for him to be able to go after it himself. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So that's two. So we have Qasir and Muqassir. One who, they're both uneducated and ignorant. One is not at fault, one is at fault. The last case is a little more tricky. Is when an individual doesn't know at all that he is doing something wrong or performing something incorrectly. They refer to this as jahl murakkab. That means there's two levels of ignorance here. The first is that he is performing something incorrectly. That's the first level of ignorance. And the second level of ignorance, which is after that, is that he doesn't know that he has the first level of ignorance. Therefore they say it's two stages of ignorance. So, your approach can obviously not be the same approach that you've had in the last two scenarios. Because the last two scenarios, the person already knows they don't know something. So in this case, you have to be a little more creative. For example, this happens a lot. We see individuals performing prayers and there are, for example, faults in their recitation. But they don't know or they don't acknowledge the fact that they have this problem. Or they're performing wudu and there's a problem in the way they're performing wudu. Or they're, for example, at a more grand stage, they're performing enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, but they're performing it incorrectly. But they're under the notion that they're doing it right. Again, we gave examples of someone who skips steps. So he sees, for example, you see this in Islamic countries a lot, and you see it here as well, but in other forms. For example, I'll tell you in Iran, if someone is walking with bad hijab, an individual who knows he's responsible towards enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, but doesn't know how to do it correctly, he skips steps and starts yelling at the person and disrespecting them. So this person also has jahl murakkab. He is also ignorant, and we are responsible towards educating them. But how? We should educate this person in a fashion that is extremely indirect, and the goal at the first level is to only create a question in their minds that maybe what they're doing is not 100% correct. That you create a doubt. You create a doubt in their mind that maybe what I'm doing is not right. So, we have examples of this in the lives of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and especially in the life of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So let's take this also a akhlaq and a moral lesson away from the Imam. We've all heard the story of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and of the old man. The two Imams once saw an old man performing wudu. And in his wudu there was a mistake. So, scenario is what? Someone is performing something wrong. He's an elder. And you, as a Muslim, know you're responsible towards enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. You can't turn the other way just because you say he's an elder individual. But they say we have to enjoin the good and forbid the evil respectfully and indirectly. So what do? They ask the old man to observe both of them in their performance of wudu. And afterwards, for him to be the judge of who has performed the wudu better. See how indirect it is? See how clever this is? So they begin to perform wudu, and the man is watching. They both finish, and now the man has an epiphany. They ask, which of us has performed wudu better? He says, neither of you, O beloveds. For it is I who have been mistaken, and I'm making the mistake in my wudu. Now the old man understands the philosophy and reasoning behind why these people have done that. They say, I thank you for showing me my mistake and fault in such a fashion. And for you not to comment bluntly, tell me, picture this, as an elder individual, if a child comes and tells you that, for example, uncle, you're performing wudu incorrectly, you'll laugh at him, that he say, okay, he's a young child, doesn't know what he's talking about. Or you'll get extremely upset and say, look how disrespectful you are. You know how old I am? You know how long I've been coming to Majlis? And you're going to tell me how to do wudu, how to pray? So, an individual needs to be clever in each circumstance, in each situation. So these are the three different forms that one must enjoin the good and forbid the evil based on the situation. And the goal is to educate them And by educating them, then we can reach the ultimate goal of creating a change in effect towards them becoming a better Muslim. Salawatullahi Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.